गीतामृतं ददौ लोकत्रयोपकाराय तस्मै कृष्णात्मने नमः। हरे कृष्णा। वेलकम बैक टू अवर भगवद गीता डिस्कशन। टुडे वी विल डिस्कस फ्रॉम 2.18 ऑनवर्ड्स। यस्टरडे वी डिस्कस्ड 2.17 अविनाशी तद्विद्धि। लेट अस मूव टू द नेक्स्ट वर्स नाउ। अन्तवन्त इमे देहा नित्यस्योक्तः शरीरिणः अनाशिनो अप्रमेयस्य तस्माद् युध्यस्व भारत। अन्तवन्त इमे देहा, दिस देहा, दिस बॉडी, इमे देह इज अन्तवन्त, इट इज गोइंग टू एंड, इट बाउंड टू एंड। नित्यस् उक्तः शरीरिणः, बट दैट विच इज इनसाइड द बॉडी शरीरिणः। Earlier the word was used dehi, so now it is sharirinaha. That is nitya, nitya soktaha sharirinaha. Anashino aprameyasya. So that is indestructible, anashino. And it is aprameyasya, it is immeasurable. Tasmad yudhyasva bharata. Tasmad yudhyasva bharata. So that means, what is the point? How does the preceding lead to the conclusion? Therefore, fight. Actually, the body is indestructible. The body is bound to be destroyed, but the soul is indestructible. So, therefore, as you know, you will not be able to save the body even if you avoid fighting, and you will not be able to destroy the soul even if you fight. So, therefore, that which is the essential nature, which is unchangeable, don't worry yourself, don't work yourself unnecessarily into a frenzy caused by anxiety based on thinking that you will be able to save the soul or you will be able to save the body. You won't be. And don't think that you will destroy the soul, because you won't. So both ways, so Prabhupada explained in the purport that actually the antavantai me deha, the body may perish in one day immediately, or it may be after 100 years. It's a question of time only. There is no chance of maintaining it indefinitely. So all of us, we are born with a death sentence on our head. There is. Material existence itself is a prison in which all of us have a death sentence on us. We are all sentenced to death. So the only thing is, we don't know when the death sentence is going to come. How long we are to live, we don't know. Just as some product may come with all products come with expiry date. This body also comes with an expiry date. The only thing is that we don't know when is the expiry date. But it is there. It can come the next moment, it can come after a year, it can come after 30-40 years. But we are all going to die. Now, there's an interesting word over here, aprameyasya. So, aprameyasya means immeasurable. So, what does immeasurable actually mean? Now, earlier, Srila Prabhupada has quoted in the previous purport itself, that keshagra shatabhagasya, that actually there is the soul which is 1/10,000 of the tip of a hair. So now, immediately after Prabhupada quotes that, the aprameyasya comes up over here. So aprameyasya essentially means that actually it is not subject to material measurement. So it's not material and it's not materially measurable. There are dimensions, so it does have dimensions, but those dimensions are not material, though they are spiritual dimensions, because the soul itself is spiritual. So aprameyasya here refers to, it is so small that it just can't be measured by our instruments of perception, and it's just immeasurable. So it's the immeasurableness is not just because of smallness. Definitely smallness is one factor, but along with that, it's because of its spiritual nature. So aprameyasya and tasmadidya. So now, what is the relation of aprameyasya with the context of indestructibility? The point is that the aprameyasya, it is so imperishable, it's so small, that even if Arjuna shoots arrows, hundreds of arrows at a person. Now, we see in the Bhagavatam that Vishwapitama was lying on a bed of arrows. There were so many arrows that even a finger, it was difficult to put a finger through those arrows. So you had so many arrows, but none of those arrows penetrated the soul. So it's continuing the point that the soul is so small that no weapons will be able to hit it. So aprameyasya. So the aprameya is given to further the point of indestructibility. We discussed in the previous verse 2.17 how yena sarvamidam tatam. So Ramacharya explains that the soul pervades everything. Soul is so subtle that its consciousness pervades everything. And actually nothing can destroy it. So the same point is being continued over here. The soul is indestructible. Now, Krishna now gives a... So in one sense, Krishna has given a call for action in the previous verse. So, tasmad yudhyasva bharata. This all instruction will come again. So whenever scriptures talk, scriptures can have multiple tones. Now when Krishna is speaking, say, dehi nosminitha dehe, that verse was there. So that is more of educational. Krishna is saying, okay, inside the body there is a soul and a wise person does not lament. So that means there is information over there, and there is also an indirect suggestion, an indirect instruction that you should also not lament, but that's not direct. So certain statements in scriptures are direct instructions. This is what you should do. So for example, nasato vidyate bhavo na bhavo vidyate sata. This is of the not eternal, there is no cessation, of the temporary, there is no endurance. Now, there is no direct instruction in this. But itam sitiksha swabharata, therefore Arjuna tolerate. This is an instruction. 2.14 is instruction. Similarly, here 2.18 is tasmad yudhyasya bharata, is instruction. So instructional statements are most important for sadhakas. The informational, educational statements, they are also important because they enable us to understand Krishna, to understand the philosophy better. From the practical point of view, the instruction statements are the most important. Just like a doctor may give a lot of information about the disease. Okay, now this is, if you have got some lung infection, so the pulmonary infection is there, basically then it says, okay, this is the infection is over here and this may happen in the future. This is how it is likely to have been caused. This is all this. These are the different ways in which this infection can affect the body. Now, all this information is important. But the most important for the information of the patient is, what should we do? What should I do? Okay, take this medicine after evening. When you start getting cough, do this, this. So like that, this is most practical, more practically relevant and important for the patient. Similarly, the scriptures give us a lot of instructions, but a lot of statements are there in the scriptures which contain a lot of information also. But within that, those statements which are in the mode of instruction, so like here, tasmad yudhyasya bharata, they are call for action directly, and they are especially important. So now, Krishna continues the same thought in the next verse by explaining how the body is, once one understands that one is not the body, then to lament for the destruction of the person is ignorance. Yenam vetti hantaram yaschainam manyate hatam ubhautau na vijanito nayam hanti na hanyate. So yenam vetti hantaram. So enam vetti, one who thinks this to be hantaram, the destroyer. Yaschainam manyate hatam, one who thinks that the soul is destroyed. Ubhautau, both of them, navijanito, neither of them actually know. Nayam hanti nahanyate, the soul neither kills nor is killed. So now, in this verse, it's easy to understand that the soul is not killed. Krishna has very clearly said that the soul is indestructible. So now, what is Krishna meaning here by saying that the soul is not the killer also? Obviously, it is Arjuna who is going to shoot the arrows. And when Arjuna shoots the arrows at his opponents, he is going to be the killer, isn't he? So actually, the statement has to be understood in context. The previous verse was saying that the body is perishable. So, because the body is perishable, the body is going to die by its own course. In the course of nature, the body's destruction cannot be avoided. So in that sense, when the soul and the body get separated at death, The point is that that sort of separation was unavoidable. And therefore, if somebody thinks I am the killer, then that is actually the kartaham iti manyate mentality. I am the doer. So, this we will discuss more when we come to 3.27 in the Bhagavad Gita, and further we'll discuss about karta in the 5th chapter. So here it is not that anybody can kill anyone and say, actually, I am hanti na hanyate. No, I am not the killer, I am not, no one is killed because the Atma is eternal. No. Actually, Prabhupada will quote in a future verse that Mahim sarvabhuteshu. Actually, Mahim, the scriptures do tell us they do not commit violence. So here Krishna is talking about the overall pattern of material nature, that the body is perishable, its destruction cannot be avoided. And he's also talking about Kshatriya, Arjuna Kshatriya duty. He cannot flinch from his duty. By flinching from his duty, he will not be able to change the course of nature. By the course of nature, people have to suffer and die. And one cannot change that by some adjustment, by some change, by dereliction of duty. One cannot do that. Therefore, why give up duty? So Krishna continues the further argument by elaborating more on the soul. Yes. So this is the next verse which is, so Prabhupada quotes actually in this verse only, Mahimsayat sarvabhutani. This verse is not a categorical license for killing indiscriminately. Not at all. So Prabhupada says, killing the body of anyone without authority is abominable, is punishable by the laws of the state as well as by the law of the Lord. Now, najayate mdiyate va kadachin nayam bhutva bhavitava nabhuyaha ajo nitya shashuto yam purano nahanyate hanyamane sharire. This is a well frequently quoted verse. Now, each of these lines has a significance. The most important from the context of Arjuna is na hanyate hanyamane sharire. When the body is destroyed, the soul is not destroyed. The soul, the part of the soul, the spiritual being, a part of Krishna, the spark of consciousness, that is na hanyate. So even when the body is destroyed, the soul is not destroyed. Now, further, na jayate mriyate va kadachin. The soul does not take birth, the soul does not die. What does it mean? Na jayate mriyate. Actually, what do we mean when the soul is na jayate, it has no birth. And also the word that is used in the third line, in 20c, is ajo. Ajo is unborn. So unborn and not taking birth. They seem to be similar. And what is the point when we say, normally if we say that, okay, the child has not yet taken birth. That means we would say the child doesn't exist. Or it would mean that a child exists in the womb but has not taken birth. So, what do we mean in the sense by soul? Being ajo. Actually, the ajo refers to the soul not having come into existence at a particular time. When we say something has come into birth, that means it had an entry into existence at a particular time. And if it has an entry into existence at a particular time, then it will also have an exit at a particular time. So the soul is just beyond the dimensions of time. The soul is transcendental. So ajo here doesn't mean non-existence, non-existent. Ajo essentially means over here, it does not come to birth. It does not come within time domain at any time. It is always eternal. And essentially, in this whole section, Krishna is using the Upanishadic strategy of naiti. Naiti, naiti, naiti. What is this naiti strategy? That when the Upanishads and the philosophical seekers, the jnanis or those inclined towards jnan mark, they need not necessarily be jnanis only, they can be devotees also, who can use introspection and intellection to analyze. So naiti process is naiti, naiti, naiti. Okay, am I this body? No, I'm not the body. The body is made up of air. Am I the air? No, I'm not the air. So who am I? So not this, not this, not this, not this. So by this process of philosophical negation, gradually one comes to affirmation. By negation of the material, we pave the way eventually for the affirmation of the spiritual. That is the process of philosophical introspection about our nature. So Krishna is using here basically the method of negation. So he's saying, na jayate, na mriyate, aja. So all the attributes that characterize the body, those do not characterize the soul. The soul does not take birth, the soul does not die, the soul is immeasurable, the soul, as we'll see in the future, is indivisible, impenetrable. So basically, all the things that apply to the body, the things don't apply to the soul. So Krishna is using the method of naiti naiti, not this, not this, to point out what the soul is indirectly. So because there is a conflation means mixing up of the body and the soul over here. So that mixing up, Krishna is unmixing, separating by first pointing out that whatever applies to the body does not apply to the soul. Now, na jayate, that soul is never takes birth. Now the concept of soul is there in most religious traditions. However, this concept is quite hazy. For example, in the Abrahamic religions are Judaism, Christianity and Islam. They talk about the soul, but when they talk about the soul, their talk is mostly, they are almost as if referring to the soul, using the soul as a reference to, as a metaphorical reference to our non-material essence. That means that there is something essential which survives to us, that is non-material, and as a metaphorical reference to our non-material essence. So the soul is not often taken literally as an entity. Now, of course, within the Abrahamic religions also, there are many different denominations. We all have their own ideas. But prominently, there's not much self-knowledge in these scriptures and in the overall tradition also. So the soul, the reference to the soul comes, but it comes more as a reference to metaphorical reference to our non-material essence. The Bhagavad Gita and the Vedic literature, on the other hand, they treat the soul as a ontological higher dimensional entity. Ontological means pertaining to the nature of existence, pertaining to reality as it is. So the soul is a literal higher dimensional entity. There is a thing called a soul. So of course it's not a thing, it's a conscious being. But the point is, we can use thing to refer to beings also. It is not just some hazy conception. It's an actual being. It's actual object. So there, the reference to the soul as a metaphorically, we can see that, you know, for example, somebody say, love God with all thy heart, all thy might and all thy soul. So now when we say all thy soul, what are we referring to over here? The heart gets its consciousness from the soul, the heart gets its emotions from the soul, the body gets energy from the soul. So when we say love God with all thy soul, what is it referring to actually? Here the soul is being referred to in a metaphorical sense. So put your entire being, your essential being, put it all into you, right? So, and we may also use this in our day-to-day language as devotees also. So the metaphoric, the use of the word soul in a metaphorical sense is not wrong. For example, when we say, put your heart and soul in doing service. So now what do we mean over here? Put your heart and soul. So first of all, when you use this word, the heart itself, we are referring to metaphorically. Metaphorically means it's not that I have to take my heart out of my chest and put it in the service. Here when we refer to the heart, we are not referring to the biological heart that beats and circulates blood all over the body. We are referring to the metaphorical heart, which is the seat of all emotions. So put your heart in doing service means that put all your emotions. You know, do the service with your emotions. As Krishna will say, Aham sarvasya pramatta sarvam pravartate iti matva bhajante bhav. Bhajante maam buddha bhava samanvita with emotions. That's 10.8 and similarly in 15.19 also he says, Yo maam eva samrujanati sa purushottamasa sarvavid bhajati maam sarvabhavena bhata sarvabhavena with all emotions. So the heart refers to the seat of emotions, metaphorically, not the biological heart. Similarly, when we have put your heart and soul in doing service, the soul also refers to, metaphorically, as the seat of consciousness. So put your consciousness into it. Put your essential being into it. Put your everything into it. So we may also use the soul, the word soul sometimes in a metaphorical sense. So, for example, when we say, I put my soul into that project. So now, what does it mean? It's not that there was some project over there, I took the soul out of the body and put it over there. So here, so sometimes as devotees also we may use the word my soul. Now, philosophical point is, I am not the body, I am the soul. That is correct. But there are times, there are occasions, when we can also use my soul. The reference to my soul we can use because it's a conventional usage and it is our essential being or our entire being. We can, when we put into something, we can say, I put my soul into that. So that is with respect to the general understanding of the soul, concept of soul in various traditions. Now, we discussed earlier how the broad religious traditions in the world can be classified into two. There are the Abrahamic religions and there are the Dharmic religions. The Abrahamic religions are Judaism, Christianity, Islam. They are often history-centered. You know, there are some specific event that happened in history and centered on that. For example, Moses taking the selected people from Egypt to the promised land, Jerusalem. Or Jesus' appearance and his resurrection. Or Muhammad's coming. They're history-centered. The Dharmic religions are, say, Buddhism, Jainism, Hinduism, Sikhism. They focus more on, that they also historical events are there and they're significant, but they're more a search for the principles of Dharma. Understanding the universal principles that underlie the universe and harmonizing with those principles. That's the focus of the Dharmic religions. So now, in the Dharmic religions, if we see Buddhism has a peculiar conception. Their concept is, there is reincarnation, but there is no soul. So in a sense, if you consider that Christianity accepts soul, but does not accept reincarnation. They consider there is only one life. We'll discuss that a little bit later. Whereas Buddhism accepts reincarnation without soul. Now we wonder if this reincarnation, what reincarnates? What is it? There has to be something which goes from one body to another. So actually, they say, no, actually, there is no such thing which goes from one body to another because there is no such thing existing right now also. So they say, what our sense of I-ness is just a residue of the flow of consciousness. So the flow of consciousness just keeps moving. And because the flow of consciousness keeps moving, that just as it moves in this life, so they say that there's not even a soul right now. So it's just a stream of consciousness that is moving forward. And that stream of consciousness continues to exist in the next life also. So they accept reincarnation without soul. Now, what is it that reincarnates? That is a question that has stymied Buddhist thinkers for millennia now. But essentially their idea is the soul, there is no such thing as soul. Anattavad, their philosophy is called as. Now there is amongst Buddhist scholars also a debate where Buddha actually taught like this. The Buddha, because he rejected the Vedic scriptures at that time, we had discussed earlier how because at that time meat eating was very prominent. So to stop people from meat eating, he said, can't you see it? There's so many animals are being killed. How can you allow meat eating like this? He said, stop meat eating. He said, but the Vedas say this. He says, forget the Vedas. So what was the idea? Reject the Vedas, because people had misunderstood the Vedas and they had shuttled down, reduced the broad Vedic program to a small, narrow program of material gratification with the justification of the Vedas. So he said, reject the Vedas. Now, without the Vedas, it is very difficult to know anything about the absolute truth, very clearly. That's why when Buddha taught, his teachings were eminently practical. He did not go into metaphysics much. So for example, at one time some person came and asked him. He says, are you a god? He said, no. Are you an angel? No. He says, are you the supreme? No. He says, like that, we asked, that person was trying to understand Buddha's identity. Who are you? So he said, I am awake. That was all that he said. Another time somebody asked him, is the soul different from the body or same as the body? So is the soul same as the body? He remained silent. Is the soul different from the body? He remained silent. And finally that person got exasperated and went away. And one of his prominent disciples, Ananda, asked him, that, you know, why did you not answer the question? He said, that person was asking questions based on the platform of ignorance. So either way, whatever I would speak, that would only reinforce the ignorance. So therefore, I decided not to do answer. So Buddha mostly avoided metaphysical answers, metaphysical issues. He focused on morality. So Buddhism is basically like a... It is sattvic culture. That was it, right? Right thought, right words, right action. So try to bring people to goodness so that eventually they can receive Vedic wisdom and attain transcendence. So it is, in that sense, a pre-theistic religion. Pre-theistic. So some people think that Buddha is atheistic, but the explicit atheist rejection of God was not taught by Buddha. Buddha did not take rejection of God. He just thought, don't talk about God. Focus on morality. Focus on practical action for improving your behavior. And he just neglected metaphysical issues. But subsequent thinkers in the Buddhist tradition, they imported a lot of concepts which were not originally there in the teachings of Buddha. So one of them was atheism. And another of them was the rejection of the soul. So Buddhism emerged from Hinduism. Of course, the word Hindu was not there at that time. But the Vedic tradition that was there, Buddhism emerged as a rebel tradition, which rejected the discriminatory caste system, which rejected Vedic authority, and established itself as an independent body of thought. Now, in their quest to establish philosophical autonomy, philosophical autonomy means, yes, we have a distinct philosophy. We are not just an offshoot of Hinduism. So they tried to come up with various ideas. And one of the ideas that they came up, many of the Buddhist thinkers, was this anattava, that there is no soul at all. So they said, Hindus believe in a soul, we don't believe in the soul. So that's how they tried to divorce themselves from Hinduism in a philosophical way also. Culturally, in some ways, it was a rebellion against Hinduism that they rejected the caste system, rejected Vedic authority. Philosophically, they came up with this idea. So it's a very unsustainable idea. Now, for example, they gave the example that now, when we see a flame, a candle, to our vision, the candle's flame remains the same. But actually, there is no same candle's flame. The candle's flame is constantly changing. So the candle's flame is just changing. And when the candle is about to get extinguished, at that time, this candle's flame is transferred to another candle's flame. And then also, the candle's flame keeps changing. So, just as the flame is constantly changing but appears to be the same, similarly, our consciousness appears to have a continuity, but it keeps changing constantly. So, however, see, this is a misunderstanding. It's a misapplied example. The Bhagavatam gives this example also in the 11th canto, and it gives the example to demonstrate, to drive home the point that we are different from the material world. And the material world, in the material world, everything is changing. So now I see this wall, I see this table, that's continuous. But actually things are constantly changing. So if we look at a microscopic level, matter is always in a state of flux. There's energy being, matter is being created, matter is being destroyed. So at the material level, everything is constantly changing. Material things are changing. And that is a fact. So there is change, but there's an illusion of continuity because of persistence of vision. Just like when a person is moving a, say, a lighted candle or lighted torch, moves round and round and round at a fast speed, then it appears to arise as if there is a circle. Why? Because our eyes, whatever we see a few moments ago, that persists in our vision. And because of that persistence of vision, what we have seen earlier continues to stay there in the eyes. And that's how we perceive things. But perceive that as a circle of fire, not just one flame, one torch of fire. So similarly, because of persistence of vision, we see this material world as continuous. This is what Bhagavatam also says. But the important point is, taking one step backward, is that there is a continuous observer who sees things as continuous. So similarly, yes, when we talk about the soul, the mind and the body. So the soul's consciousness, when it expresses itself in the material world, it's constantly changing. But there is a seat of consciousness, there is a source of consciousness which is continuous. And that is very important to understand. That, what is the difference between consciousness and soul? The soul is like the locus of consciousness. Locus means the center, focus, focal point, the center. From which, so it is, we could say it is the root of consciousness, R-O-O-T. Root, it is the root from which consciousness is coming out. So, now, in the candle example, the candle is the source of the flame. But that is incorrect because the body is not the source of consciousness. The soul is the source of consciousness, and the body is being material, has no capacity to produce consciousness. The body is the soul of consciousness. The body is simply the root through which the consciousness is being expressed in the world. So the material manifestations of consciousness are temporary. They are changing. So for example, our moods change. So what we thought, the kind of thought that we have, they keep changing. But I as the person remain the same. Now, in this way, when we think about it, there is, the body is changing, and when the consciousness is expressed through the body, that is also changing. But the person who is the observer, the person who is the source of consciousness, that person remains the same. So why are we discussing all this over here? We are discussing how there are various misconceptions that come up about the soul, and the Bhagavad Gita gives the clear conception. So in the Christian tradition, for example, they have the idea that the soul is semi-eternal. Now what do we mean by semi-eternal? Actually, their conception is, in the Christian tradition again, reincarnation was originally accepted. There are references to reincarnation in the Bible also. Not explicitly, but implicitly. So, there are many prophets who are considered to be reincarnations of previous prophets. And similarly, Jesus talks about reincarnation. For example, there's a blind person. And Jesus asks the disciples, so, okay, why is this person born blind? Is it because of this person's wrong misdeeds? Or is it because of the parents' misdeeds? So then, when this discussion is going on between Jesus and disciples, so at that time, Jesus, in that particular case, says that actually that person's blindness is meant to demonstrate the glory of God. And then, he ensures that the blind person gets eyes. So now, the point over here is, Jesus does not reject the idea that that person could have done something wrong. And when would that person... Now, there are two possibilities. The two possibilities that are presented before Jesus is that that person did something wrong or the parents did something wrong. Now, in that specific case, Jesus removed the blindness of the person. But is it that the blindness will be removed for everyone? No. So what Jesus demonstrated was an exceptional case of mercy. But what about the universal instance occurrences of blindness? What is the reason for that? So Jesus does not answer the question at a philosophical level over here. But what he does say is very... What he does not say is also important. Now he does not refute the idea that a child, the person, could have been responsible. Now, how would the person have been responsible? If a person is born blind, what could the person have done to actually be born blind? What could have done? Put the legs in a karmically wrong way inside the mother's womb, folded the legs the wrong way. There's nothing that the person could have done. So, the whole idea is that there is reincarnation, we use a general word. There is pre-existence and there is afterlife. So this is our present existence. So reincarnation includes pre-existence and afterlife also. So afterlife means that when we die, after that life continues. That is called afterlife. And pre-existence means before we are born, even at that time life continues to exist. We continue to exist. So in the Christian tradition, pre-existence is not accepted as it is now. But as I said, Jesus does not reject outright the possibility that the person could have done something wrong. So when did the person do something wrong? That is in pre-existence. Pre-existence means in the life earlier to this life. So in that sense, certainly we can say reincarnation is not incompatible with the Christian tradition, with Christian wisdom. Although it may not be accepted today, Satyaraj Prabhu, one of his scholarly devotees, has written a book called The Reincarnation Controversy, in which he gives a detailed account of how the concept of reincarnation was banished from Christian beliefs during the rule of Constantine and due to a complex web of theopolitics. Theopolitics means politics connected with religion. So basically, Christianity, after it was started, and at that time, the Roman Empire was ruling Europe as well as the parts of Jerusalem, Israel. They had more or less their rule over there. And the parts where Jesus was born also. So Gethsemane and all those places. Now, the Christians, they started preaching. And as they started preaching and spreading, many of them were persecuted by the Romans. However, around the 4th century, for first 2-3 centuries, many Christians were terribly persecuted. But by the 4th century, the Roman Empire itself collapsed. Collapsed not just because of external attacks, but collapsed because of internal decay. And then at that time, to bring back basic morality, the Roman Emperor adopted Christianity as the official religion. When he adopted Christianity as the official religion, it was a remarkable change in the fortunes of Christianity. After having survived for 4 years of persecuted religion, it certainly became the religion in power. And it's tragic that then Christians started doing to others the same thing that were done to them. They started persecuting all the other people who had beliefs different from them. So heathens, Jews, all these people, they were severely persecuted. In the next maybe 1,000-1,500 years, when the Roman Catholic Church had tremendous political power, there were inquisitions which were held. Inquisition means any person who had heretical beliefs. For example, there was a thinker called Bruno, and Bruno talked about the immortality of the soul. And just because he talked about the immortality of the soul, he was burned alive. So there was an inquisition. So of course, this is all accretion. Accretion means additional discussion. Our primary discussion right now is that how the idea of eternality of the soul was banished from Christianity, of reincarnation, not just eternality, eternality in the sense that pre-existence also and multiple incarnations. So at that time, when the Roman Emperor accepted Christianity, the primary focus was not on philosophical fidelity, not on accurately following Christianity. It was the primary focus was political expediency. Political expediency means what was convenient. The king wanted to maintain the rule, and for that, people needed to have some basic morality. And that was what the morality was there among Christians, and that's why he adopted Christianity. But his idea was that if you told people that you have many chances, then people will become lax in following morality. And what was following morality essentially meant? Following the laws of the king, because the king was considered to be the representative of God. So the pagan Roman Empire had now become the Holy Roman Empire. And the Holy Roman Emperor was considered to be the representative of God here. So then the king wanted people to follow him. And he taught, it's a long history, he said that give them one life or give them eternal hell. And that will make sure they'll follow the laws. They'll fear God and they'll follow the laws of God. So basically there are, there's quite a significant amount of evidence which shows how during the councils of the church, systematically the ideas that supported the sections of the scriptural sections and the traditional references which supported reincarnation were purged out or were downplayed and were anathemized. Anathemized means they were declared as anathema. So there's a very prominent Christian thinker called Origen. He was, St. Augustine considered to be the most prominent among the early Christian thinkers, and Origen was the second most, almost a few rungs below Augustine. And he had talked about reincarnation, but he was anathemized. His teachings were declared as deviant, and especially teachings about the reincarnation of the soul were also denigrated and rejected. So that's how within Christianity the idea of the soul has become rejected. Now the problem with this is, once this idea of reincarnation has become removed. So then what happens when the concept of reincarnation is exiled? There are several serious issues that come up. For example, the iniquities of this world can't be explained. You know, why this person is born blind and this person is born with eyes? There's no explanation for that. It just becomes arbitrary. Okay, this is the way things are and this is the way you have to accept them. So if we understand that there is a past life and people get the consequences for what they have done in the same life as well as in future lives, then we understand that it is we who are responsible for our choices, and by making better choices we can create a better future for ourselves. So accepting God's goodness becomes difficult when God is seen as partial. God and arbitrary. You know, some people is given eyes, some people are not given eyes. Why like this? It becomes very difficult to explain that. Some people are born with, born in wealth, some people are born poor. Why? All such things become very, very difficult to explain. So when you're talking about the soul and the reincarnation of the soul, it's all very related. You know, if there were a cricket match in which the team started, there's the two teams are starting the match, and one team, their score at the starting itself is 200, and the other team score is 0. You say, what is going on here? Why does this team have a score of 200? So, now there are two possibilities. One is that the people who have organized the match, they only fix the match. They want this team to win, so they have given that team a score of 200. And the other possibility is that scoreboard works by chance. Somehow, by chance, that scoreboard has come 200. So now, both of these alternatives are very unsatisfactory. So if so what does it mean? You know, what we're talking about is, why is one person born blind? One person is born with eyes. One person is born in poverty. One person is born in wealth. So this is like one person is having 0 score, another is having a 200 score. So imagine, now if in our day-to-day life when we act, we don't act as if things work randomly. If a student studies, student gains knowledge, and then student gives the papers and gets marks. So the first idea is that a scoreboard is just working by chance. So then, what will be the point of the game? Some batsman, the fast bowlers, then the batsman accurately swings and hits a sixer. And he finds that at the scoreboard, the score becomes -6. What will be the point of playing left like that? So even in something as recreational, not, we could say not as serious as real life, even in something as recreational as a sport, we understand that there is cause-effect connection. Okay, play this, and this will happen. Do this will happen. Now on the other hand, if we say in real life there is no correlation between what we do and what we get, then it's a doctrine of helplessness. No, I hit sixer after that, and just my score gets negative, negative, negative. And the person just defends the ball from hitting the stumps, and that person keeps scores keep increasing. That would be absurd. So we don't operate in life like this, and life doesn't work like this. So what we act, the results come to us accordingly. So the Vedic wisdom, so the idea that things are happening by chance in the world, some people are born wealthy, poor or blind because of just bad luck. That makes the doctrine of helplessness. On the other hand, the idea that there is a God who is biased, that's even worse. The idea that actually there is God who makes things go wrong. Why? So when that is asked, actually we can't know why. That is the idea. So it is the will of God, and we just have to accept the will of God. So all this makes things very complex. So all these ideas that there is a God, but God arbitrarily decides. Some people are born blind, some people are born with eyes, some people are born poor, some people are born wealthy. This makes God appear discriminatory. So it's like the team or the match organizer only giving extra marks to one team. Some people will say, "Oh, we cannot understand the will of God." Yes, that is fine. We cannot understand the will of God in specific situations, but there has to be some broad understanding of God. Otherwise, how will we develop love for God? If God is so arbitrary to do anything for anyone, how do we actually understand what God is, what God is doing, and how can we develop love for a person who acts in arbitrary ways? So, actually, when faced with these two alternatives, that everything happens by chance, there is no God in control, and God is in control, but God acts arbitrarily. It's both are unacceptable, but it becomes very difficult to stomach the idea of an arbitrary God. And many people, even if they have inclinations towards believing in God, they prefer atheism, because yes, things are happening by chance. That's a much more intellectually acceptable alternative. So, which is actually correct? So actually, there's a third alternative. It's possible that one team score is 200, another team score is zero. Why? Because this is the second innings. In a previous innings, that team has got a lead, and that lead is being reflected over here. So similarly, one person is born wealthy as compared to another person because that person has done something good in the previous life, and the past life karma is coming over to this life. So, yes, there is a controller. There is a controller. Things are not happening by chance, but the controller also doesn't act arbitrarily entirely. The controller acts based on an understanding. There are laws operating, and the controller is basically overseeing the operating of those laws. So the controller is not arbitrary. So we get what we deserve. According to what, the way we act, we get the results. So this is actually a very sanity restoring and hope engendering understanding. Sanity restoring because yes, things are not just insane. There is arbitrary chance or there's arbitrary God. No. There is order and God is overseeing the order. So it restores sanity and it engenders hope. How it engenders hope? Because we understand that actually God is in charge. And if I act properly now, I can create a brighter future for myself. So all this we are discussing right now to talk about how the knowledge of the soul and its reincarnation has a positive effect on life, on our conception of life. Because when we think of ourselves just as lumps of matter who are going to be destroyed, it reduces life to meaninglessness. So na jayate mriyate, that was the context. So in the Christian idea, not in all Christian idea, most Christian denominations, they have the idea the soul is semi-eternal. Semi-eternal means there's also many Christians have different ideas, but a prominent idea is the soul is once created, so every time a man and a woman unite, at that time the soul is created. Because there's no concept of reincarnation. So there was no pre-existence. So every time the man and woman unite, at that time the soul is created. And after the soul is created, soul has one lifetime. So then, after that, if in that one lifetime the soul accepts Jesus as a savior, and the soul will go back to God to live happily. Otherwise, that soul will go to hell forever and burn in the fires of hell. So this raises serious questions about God's kindness. So what happens to all the people who are born in such a place that they never get to hear about Jesus? Will they all go to hell? And why? Just because they are born in a particular place? Why did God make them born over there? There is no previous life, so there is no rhyme and reason why God, why they should be born in a place where they never get a chance to know about God. And they go to hell. Or, for that matter, what about souls? All the souls who lived before Jesus came. They never heard about Jesus because Jesus came after them. So how will they be delivered? So further, it raises questions. One time I was traveling in a train with a Christian. So this Christian started arguing that Jesus is the only way. I said, fine, if Jesus is the only way, then what happens to, we're discussing about meat eating. And so then the topic came up. I told how Jesus, Prabhupada said, thou shalt not kill. So why do you kill animals? He says, actually that doesn't refer to human beings. I say, it's not said like that over there. It's just a generic instruction, thou shalt not kill. He says, if you're concerned about killing, then why are you so concerned about animals? You know, why don't we talk about the stopping of the abortion? There are so many embryos that are, babies that are being killed when they're unborn. So I said, oh, so you're against abortion? He said, yes, of course, it's murder. Okay. I said, now see, your idea is that the soul has to take birth and the soul has to accept Jesus as a savior and the soul will go back to it. That means Jesus is the only way, right? He said, yes. So then, what happens to the souls who are aborted? They never got an opportunity to come to know about Jesus. What will happen to them? Will they all go to hell? He says, no. Actually, they are unborn, so they are innocent. So they will all go back to Jesus. He said, okay. And what is the goal of life? He says, to go back to Jesus, to go back to God. He said, okay. Now, if all those are aborted, they go back to God, then why not abort everyone? It's a sure shot way that everybody will go back to God. He says, no, how can you do that? That's murder. He says, no, what is the goal of life? The goal of life is to go back to God. Now, if we don't abort people, then they will take birth and they may not come to know about Jesus, or even if they come to know about Jesus, they may not surrender to Jesus. They may not accept Jesus as their Savior. Then what will happen? They will go to hell. So if we abort people, then we are guaranteeing that they will go back to God. But if we don't abort them and let them take birth, then we are creating the risk that they will not go back to God and they will go to hell, in fact. So actually speaking, this idea of only one lifetime, it is filled with serious logical flaws. You know, that God gives only one chance, and that also not a proper chance to everyone. That, you know, one chance you get. If you don't accept God, Jesus in this life, then you're going to go to hell forever. Even an ordinary parent gives the children more than one chance. So what to speak of the supreme parent, who is supposed to be supremely compassionate. So this idea of ajaha means that the soul is eternal. So eternity normally means no beginning and no end. But many Christian theologians have a different understanding of eternal. That eternity is no end. A soul has a beginning, but a soul has no end. Which is a peculiar idea, but that's their idea. The soul has a beginning, but there is no end to the soul. So such ideas are refuted by the Bhagavad Gita's clear reference, ajaha. Ajaha. The soul is unborn. So further, when Krishna says, Nayam Bhutva Bhavitavana Bhuyaha. So what it indicates is, so Prabhupada translates this as, the soul has not come into being, the soul does not come into being and will not come into being. What this essentially means it, that the soul exists beyond the time dimension. The concept of coming into being is used to refer to coming into the time dimension. The soul is never inside the time dimension, soul is beyond the time dimension always. Now, after describing this, now there is some repetition, and Prabhupada explains that the repetition indicates the importance of the subject. So, in order that a subject be clearly understood, some points are repeated. So, the indestructibility of the soul is being repeated, and Prabhupada quotes a verse from the Katha Upanishad. which is remarkably similar. In fact, the last two lines are entirely similar. The first two lines are slightly different. Najayate mruyate va kadachin it was. Here it is va vipashchin. Now vipashchin refers to it has consciousness. Or it has a capacity to discriminate. Vipashchitaha will be a word that Krishna will use later on in the same chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. In the Siddha Pragya section. Now, nayam kutashchin navubhuva kashin. This is the only line that is different. So, this indicates that we have similar verses in the Bhagavad Gita which are similar to the verses that are given in the Upanishads. The soul is conscious. And Prabhupada also explained that the soul does not undergo the six changes. The body only undergoes changes. It is eternally youthful. And Prabhupada quoted a similar verse like the two birds analogy that this is a famous analogy, as we know, that there are two birds. Ano raniyam mahato mahiyan atmas chantor nihito guhayam tamakratu pashyati vitashoka dhatu prasadan mahim mahim anam atmana. So there are two birds. One bird is pecking at the fruits and then gets good fruits is happy, when gets bad fruits is miserable. The other bird is observing calmly. And the observing bird is the super soul, the pecking bird, the eating bird is the soul. Soul is trying to enjoy through the body and is suffering at times. Whereas, sometimes rejoicing, sometimes suffering, overall continuing on in the miserable material existence. The super soul is observing. If the soul just turns around and turns towards the super soul and surrenders to the super soul, the soul can become free from all miseries. So, this is talking about how the soul can regain its eternal nature. Reinstate itself in the situation, in the life of eternity. Now, next verse, Veda vinashinam nityam yena majam avyayam katham sa purusha partha kam ghatayati hantikam. Veda vinashinam nityam. Veda avinashinam. That it is nityam. Avinashi and nityam. Yena majam avyayam. Same point as we talked about. This is unborn and imperishable. So this is a rhetorical way of continuing and repeating the point that was made in 19th verse, that this person neither kills nor is killed. So kam ghatayati hantikam. So who is the killer and who is the killed? The atma is eternal, the body is destructible. So therefore, who is the killer of the indestructible soul? Nobody. The soul cannot be killed, so therefore there is no killer. And in this way, Krishna is emphatically driving home the point that the soul is eternal. So, 2.13 introduced the concept of the soul as a specific being. And now, after talking about the soul as indestructible, then from the next verse onwards, Krishna will talk about how the soul continues to exist even in the next life. So, he will emphasize, drive home the indestructibility of the soul further, and then he will talk about the future, how the soul gets a next body. That we'll discuss in our future class. Thank you. Hare Krishna.